This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The first question this month is from Hayley, and she wrote in to say, I live on the Wirral, and today around 3 p.m. the sun appeared to have a strip of colour to its side. It was like a mini rainbow, but not as colourful. Also, it seemed to reflect, causing it to look like there were two suns in the sky. What would cause this?
All right, yeah, so this is a phenomenon that we've seen a few times recently that I think you get it really when you've got some nice cold weather and some clear skies as well. And it's actually caused by ice crystals in the upper atmosphere. And the rather bizarre name given to it is sun dogs.
Sun dogs?
I actually have no idea why it's called sun dogs. But you basically see these things either side of the sun often, and Hayley talks about seeing one on one side of the sun, but quite often you'd see them sort of symmetrically placed either side. Or sometimes, that's usually when the sun's low down. If the sun's higher up, you can sometimes get a full ring around the sun. That's called a halo. And basically what happens is there's ice crystals in the upper atmosphere, and they're hexagonal ice crystals that form. And as the sunlight passes through these crystals, it's actually deflected. It's refracted through the face of the crystal. So it goes in through one side of the crystal, it comes out through a face on the opposite side of this hexagonal crystal, and it turns out the sort of, so it's basically a refraction effect, just like you get with water droplets that form a rainbow. And so you get this sort of little mini rainbow effect either side, which is why you could see that sort of coloured fringing as the light split up into the different colours. And you actually get it, it actually appears at an exact angle of 22 degrees away from the sun. So if you sort of point at the sun and then point at one of these sun dogs, the angle will be 22 degrees, and it's because of the angle of refraction through the faces of this hexagonal crystal that you get a minimum deflection of light of 22 degrees. So quite interesting things to study.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so you do spot them if you keep an eye out. I think if you see these, sometimes you see these sort of fringing colours around the moon or the sun sometimes that are rather closer than that, and I think those are not the ice crystals, but they're more like a sort of water droplet effect from the atmosphere. But these sun dogs are these hexagonal ice crystals.
Awesome. I'll definitely be keeping a lookout for those.
Yeah.
Our next question is from Patrick, who asks, what is the most interesting thing you can find on the other side of planets that you wouldn't normally be able to see in the night sky?
Ah, okay. So, an interesting question. I think most... most planets, you know, planets basically rotate, typically. So, for example, if you pick Jupiter and you looked at Jupiter through a small telescope, you might be lucky enough to see the Great Red Spot, which is this big sort of storm in the atmosphere of Jupiter. But because Jupiter rotates, sometimes the Great Red Spot will be on the far side of Jupiter, and you just have to wait until it comes around the front side. I mean, even the Sun actually rotates about once every 28 days. So if we're looking at things like sunspots or active regions and these sort of flares or prominences, you actually see them sort of come into view from the far side of the sun and then disappear again around the other side sort of 2 weeks later. Which is why we've got these spacecraft called Stereo, where there's these two spacecraft headed off, around the sun basically, so that we're able to now see all sides of the sun. We've basically got it surrounded with Stereo, so you can see the far side as well as near side. But I think probably the most interesting object, which is not technically a planet, but our moon, is quite interesting to think about what you can see from one side or the other side, because for the moon, we're actually tidally locked, which means that the sort of gravitational pull between the Earth and the moon has locked it in orbit, so that the rotation period for the moon is the same length of time as it takes for it to orbit the Earth, 28 days. So basically it stays with one face pointing towards us all the time, which means that we only ever get to see the near side. And the far side was unknown until we first sent a spacecraft out there to travel beyond the moon and have a look. And actually that was done by the Russians in October of 1959. It was a spacecraft called Luna 3. And it was tracked by Jodrell Bank. So at that time the Russians, there wasn't very much around for people to track these early spacecraft. So the Lovell telescope at Jodrell was quite important in that regard. And the Russians actually used to fax all the details of the spacecraft to Jodrell, to Bernard Lovell at Jodrell. They used to sort of tell him when they were launching it, what the frequencies were they were going to be transmitting on and so on, just so that he could actually listen in and partly confirm that they were really doing what they said they were doing. So we actually did track Luna 3 as it headed round to the far side of the moon, and it took photographs and sent those photographs back to Earth. They actually took real photographs, and they actually had to be developed automatically on the spacecraft.
Oh wow, on the spacecraft.
On the spacecraft, yeah. And then when they got the developed photograph, there was a little scanning system that scanned the photograph in and then turned that into a radio signal and sent it back to Earth. So although I think, I'll put a link to the information on our website about this, but it seems that we did pick up some of those photographic signals that were sent, but we didn't actually turn them into photos because, well, either it wasn't the actual photo, it was a test signal, or we didn't actually pick them up at the time the actual photos were sent. But certainly the Russians were the first to produce these photos of the far side of the moon, and it looks very different. It's really heavily cratered compared to the near side. The near side's got all these maria, these seas, Sea of Tranquility and so on, which we think are just sort of lava plains. And the far side doesn't really look like that. So that's either something to do with it being perhaps more heavily impacted because it's facing away from the Earth, maybe. Or a recent idea is that actually there were two moons originally in orbit around the Earth, and one of them collided with the main moon, if you like, and that collision caused the surfaces of our moon to be rather different from one side to the other. So that's still something that we're thinking about. And these NASA GRAIL spacecraft, which have been renamed GRAIL A and B, which I think were renamed Ebb and Flow recently, which is quite a nice
ebb and flow,
which is quite good because they've been producing the tides, you see, so it's quite a nice link there. They're one of the things they're interested in is studying the interior of the moon by its gravity as they orbit the moon, and maybe that will help us understand why the moon's far side looks so different to its near side.
Oh, brilliant. That should be really, really interesting.
Mm. Yeah, we'll have to look out for that as the results come through.
Now we have a message from Alexandra in Poland, who's written in to say, what would happen to the Earth in the absence of the Sun? I mean, where would Earth fall to? In the absence of gravity, would the Earth fall to infinity?
So I guess it's what would happen if the Sun suddenly disappeared.
Yeah.
So apart from it getting very cold and very dark and not being very comfortable, what would happen is the Earth would fly off, because the Earth is sort of orbiting the Sun currently, so it's the... Imagine the Earth doesn't fall directly into the Sun because it's actually moving sideways. So in a sense, the Earth is falling towards the Sun, but it keeps missing it. It sort of falls around and around and around the Sun. So if you suddenly manage to take away the Sun and therefore lose the gravitational pull of the Sun on the Earth would sort of carry on moving in the direction it happened to be moving in. Now, that doesn't mean that it will sort of head off to infinity, because the Earth is actually still bound to the Milky Way. It's the gravity of the whole of the galaxy, if you like, would keep the Earth bound to the Milky Way. So I think you wouldn't head off into infinity, you know, directly, but we would sort of continue to travel around the Milky Way. And I guess one thing is worth thinking about: how fast might all this be happening? The orbital speed of the Earth is about 30 kilometers a second. So we're moving now at about 30 kilometres a second as we travel around the Sun. And if you think how long that would take you to get anywhere, if we happen to have been travelling in the direction of the nearest star, it would take over 40,000 years for the Earth to get there. So we might travel head off into space, but we wouldn't be going anywhere particularly fast. So I think that probably answers Alexander's question.
Yeah, definitely. We have a question from Christoph, and he says, why does the method of gravitational lensing work if normal matter, which is used in this method as I understand, only makes up 5% of all mass in the universe? Is dark matter just too dispersed to interfere with this process?
Right, well, I mean, gravitational lensing, just to explain what that is, first of all, it's basically an effect caused by the curvature of space-time, which is something that Einstein suggested as part of his general theory of relativity. So objects with mass effectively change the geometry of space-time, they curve space-time. And then light, which travels on the shortest path through space-time, is actually effectively appears to bend around massive objects. So in gravitational lensing, what you imagine is you imagine us sort of sitting here and looking out into space at a distant object. And the first object for which this effect was seen was a quasar. And it was actually seen by a group of astronomers at Jodrell Bank back in the late 1970s. So if you looked at this distant quasar, what happens is the light from that quasar is actually bent around an object between us and the quasar. And for this first one, it's called the double quasar because the light was split and effectively formed two images of the same quasar off in distant space. Now, in fact, the question here is, the confusion is that actually, yes, normal matter can cause gravitational lensing, but dark matter also causes gravitational lensing because dark matter still has mass. In fact, that's how we know it's there, is because of its gravitational effect. So although it doesn't produce any light, and hence the name dark matter, it does have gravity, and therefore it does contribute to gravitational lensing. And actually, because there's five times as much dark matter, we think, as normal matter, if you want to call it that, the normal stuff around us that we're made of, because there's five times more dark matter than normal matter, actually its effects dominate in gravitational lensing studies. So gravitational lensing is one of the best ways we have of studying dark matter, and we have to certainly take into account its effects when we're looking at the sort of distortion of the images of galaxies and clusters and so on, caused by the dark matter of intervening clusters or intervening galaxies.
Fantastic. And that's all the questions that we have for this month. But please send in any of your questions that you want answered via the webpage at www.jodcast.net.